funding, U.S. military equipment, and then somehow appearing on the surface as if there is some contradiction here between the U.S. and Turkey. At the moment, as you said in the beginning, Turkey, Israel, and the U.S. collectively are trying to carve out this land, and Kurds are under threat. And also, I have to say, one important thing is even during the Assad regime, Turkey was preventing the Kurds from sitting at the negotiating table to determine the future of a democratic Syria. And Turkey is doing that right now. While HDS have been giving some messages that Kurds could be included in this process, that is after that the Turkish foreign minister made several visits, signaled that, hey, we've been supporting HDS for the past 11 years. And so Turkey is trying very hard to prevent Kurds from sitting at the negotiating table. And that's a very big loss for the region in general.
And of course, we'll continue to cover this. Özlem Gunat, want to thank you so much for being with us. Associate Professor at Department of Sociology and Anthropology at College of Staten Island, and also at the CUNY Graduate Center here in Manhattan. Happy birthday to Narmeen Maria. Tune in tomorrow to our tribute to the blacklisted lyricist Yip Harburg, the man who put the rainbow in The Wizard of Oz, his song sung by millions around the world. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are tuned to KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. December's Governance and Policy Committee meeting will be rescheduled for January 21st at 6 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO's Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, where we bring you a range of community-oriented programming built by community members like you.
Help KBOO reach our $75,000 goal by December 31st so we can bring you another great year of cutting-edge radio made by you, for you. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 to contribute today.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio, and this is KBOO News Year in Review. Between now and the new year, we'll be looking back at some of our favorite and most important stories from 2024. I'm Althea Billings, the news director. In this episode, we'll be looking back at our special election series, Running on Air. For 2.5 months, we put out a second daily show with a handful of the candidates from each district on the show each day. It was an enormous amount of effort, but it paid off. We got a unique look into the personalities and policies that would come to lead Portland into its next chapter. Today, we're going to be looking back at the episodes that featured the winners from District 2, which represents North and Northeast Portland. The winners from that district were Samir Kanal, Dan Ryan, and Ilana Pirtle-Guinea. We'll be hearing from all of them from across the different episodes that they were a part of. Before we get into the meat of today's episode, we want to thank everyone who has helped to contribute to our end-of-year membership drive so far. Our goal is to raise $75,000 before January 1st, and we can't do it without your help. The theme of this drive is Catalog of Connections, something KBOO News brings to you every weekday. Do you want to be connected to your community and the issues that matter most? That's what you tune into KBOO for. We can't do it without you. So if KBOO has meant something to you this year, consider supporting us with a donation. You can go online to kboo.fm/give to donate. You can text the word KBOO to 44321. You can also mail us a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thank you so much. Now, on to the show. Let's start with Ilana. Why did you decide to run for city council in District 2?
I love Portland. I believe in Portland's future. I think we have amazing things ahead of us, and I really want this new system of government to work because I'm concerned that if we don't get off on the right foot as we make a whole host of changes here that we have coming in our community, it's going to be really hard to bring our community together. And as I look at Portland over the last few years, it's felt like we have become more and more splintered as a community. And I see this as an opportunity to bring folks back together, really get back to who is it that we are as a community and what does that say about how we address our challenges and where are we heading? What type of community are we building? I worry, though, that if we don't have people on this first council who know how to make a legislative body work, because that's what this is, this really is a miniature legislative body, that we're not going to get there.
You both mentioned this need to be an effective legislative body. Let's spend a minute on that. What does that look like to your mind?
We are building a whole new council. And when voters passed charter reform, they gave us a whole lot of changes all at once. And I think at the end of the day, what Portlanders are hoping for is culture change at the city. Mm-hmm. And I've heard people talk about that in a few different ways. The commission that set the salary for new counselors said that they wanted that salary to be something that a single parent could live off of. When charter reform was passed, we talked about making sure that this was a council where anybody in our community could run for office. And the way that we set up the council and that we set up our work will significantly affect whether or not we meet those goals and will significantly affect whether or not we're able to better represent our communities and be active participants in our communities in a way that we haven't before. So I think about things like, let's make sure that all of our committee hearings and council meetings are 3 days a week so that 2 days a week we can be in district with constituents. We can be with Portlanders, not downtown with lobbyists. How do we make sure that we're setting a schedule that a single parent could work? How do we make sure that we are setting up our committees so that those values really do translate into the policies?
Well, I want to ask a little bit about your approach and your background. This is your first time running for office, but you've been working in Oregon politics in different capacities for a while, both with Governor Brown and with Boley at different points. You also spent years with the Oregon AFL-CIO. Are there skills that you built in labor organizing that you think will apply to council?
Absolutely. When I was at the AFL-CIO, I did organizing work, I did advocacy, I did coalition building, and all of that work boiled down to bringing people together and figuring out how we could get folks as close to the same page as possible, how we could identify the real needs of community, and then turn that into policy language.
This district representation is a huge opportunity in this new form of government, and you know, specifically talking about District 2, to have North and Northeast Portland have a bigger voice in city government. What do you see as the biggest issues facing District 2?
District 2 faces a lot of the same challenges that the city as a whole does. We have housing that is unaffordable. We have folks who are living on the streets. We have the whole suite of interconnected crises that are facing our city. But I want to point out a couple of things that are unique to District 2. And I preface it that way because I don't want it to sound like I am underestimating the importance of those issues in District 2, but I do think we have a few issues that you don't see as much in the rest of the city. And where I start is around resilience, because District 2 faces, I think, a disproportionate number of challenges as we think about resilience. We have at least 3 and probably 5 communities that in an earthquake would be completely cut off from the rest of the city because they're only accessible by bridges that would fail or by crossing a train tunnel that could collapse. We have an entire community, one of those communities that would be cut off in an earthquake, that will receive some of the most significant impact if the critical energy hub falls into crisis, whether that's an explosion, a fire. The critical energy hub is the place where we store, it's 80 or 90% of the state's fossil fuel supply reserves are stored on ground that will liquefy in an earthquake. We have communities that are right up against our levee system, which, depending on who you ask, is either a very strong system that's doing well or a system that needs a whole lot of work. And we finally passed some funding this last election to start that work. But a number of folks are very concerned that that needs to kick into gear quickly or else some of those communities will be at risk as well.
Over the summer, KBOO surveyed our listeners to figure out what their priorities were for this election, and there was a number of priorities that emerged, but the one that came up most frequently was the climate crisis. I have an assumption about how you might feel about the climate crisis, but is this a priority that you share, and how would you shape Portland's approach to the climate crisis going forward?
This absolutely has to be a part of every decision we make. Candidates love little quippy groups of three. And one of the things that I have talked about a lot on this campaign is that as we think about our long term in Portland, right, what does our future look like? We need to be making decisions that make our community and our economy both more equitable, more sustainable, and more resilient. And I say that because if we are making decisions that don't advance at least one and hopefully two or three of those things, we're not investing in our future. Just hard stop. There's no way around that. So we need to be looking, like Jennifer said, at the sustainability impacts and the resilience impacts, and I would add the equity impacts of every decision we make. If we want to do our part, right, we're Portland, we're a medium-sized city, we are not going to address climate change all on our own, but if we want to do our part, we have to be building in sustainability to all of our decisions. We have to be thinking about green space differently. As we become a more dense city, there will be less of what I like to call private green space, backyards. We have to have more public green space and think more creatively about how we have room for that within our city. I also think we need to look at climate and sustainability as it relates to our economy. And Portland has a lot of challenges right now around our economy, but as I think about what are our opportunities, what are the things that Portland is known for, the places where we could really lean in, I think there's a lot of opportunity to look at funding we do have available, our industrial spaces that are in many cases underutilized right now because we've lost a few large industrial employers, and our history with sustainability, and think about how we could lean into green manufacturing, green tech manufacturing as a solution for our economy that also helps increase sustainability, not just in our community, but in those ways we actually could be a leader nationally or internationally with some of the work that I think we could be doing here.
What do you think Portland should do about Zenith?
I think that there are a few very basic things we could do to mitigate risk. And the first of those is that when Zenith was required to run their crisis response practice, they cut corners on that. And I don't see in the near future, I know this is not an answer people like, but in the near future, I don't see us kicking Zenith out of our community completely. But if they are going to be here, we need to have some standards around how they operate, and allowing them to cut corners on basic safety planning should have been completely unacceptable, and they need to redo that safety planning. There are also some basic things like we passed funding at the state. I actually helped secure the funding at the state for our earthquake and fire response systems, shake alert and fire alert in the state. And those could be integrated into all of the operations at the critical energy hub and integrated into industrial operations across the city. None of the users, last I heard, at the critical energy hub have integrated those alert systems. Now, with an earthquake when you're on ground that's going to liquefy, not a lot you can do, but there may be some things. And with fire alert, there actually is a lot that they could do because you get more advanced warning with something like that. That's not the trains, but they're related. And I think both of those pieces point to Zenith not taking the precautions that they need to be a good neighbor in the community that they have asked to operate in. And that is that's a really big problem. Oh, I just wanted to add something. Not all of the tanks in the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub are being used. Portlanders in general, and the city council included in that, doesn't know which tanks are being used and which are not being used. And some of those tanks are significantly older and have significantly more degradation than others. So having a conversation with all of the users at the Critical Energy Hub about which tanks are the least likely to cause harm to the community, and let's make sure that fuels are stored there, and that if there is excess capacity, which I believe there is, those tanks are decommissioned. That's another small step that could have a big impact that is achievable, right? We're not talking about things that that companies can't do.
Do you think that Portlanders have the patience for long-term change and for engaging in these types of projects? Because I perceive a sort of fickleness, but maybe that comes from the current city council.
So I think this matters when we talk about sustainability and climate change. I think it matters when we talk about housing. I also think it matters when we talk about the economy and what it takes to create more good jobs in Portland. And you started to touch on the answer there. Portlanders absolutely have the patience to do big, important things. We've done it before. But I don't think our leaders over the past 10 years in our city have had the patience for long-term planning and long-term projects. And I want to put an asterisk there. Yes, we do have some long-term plans that have come out of council over the last year or two. But in terms of picking a project and seeing it through, we haven't seen that type of leadership. And when our leaders are constantly chasing shiny things, the community is absolutely going to look at all of those new opportunities that we have. But I think if we had a council where our leaders said, hey, we need to do these things well, and that's going to take some discipline and commitment, that Portland would be there right with us to do that. Hmm. We need to have both vision and follow through. And we also need to have some honest conversations about what is effective and what's not effective. Really looking at, you know, we like to do things our own way in Portland and in Oregon. And we can look at what has worked in other places and make those Portland solutions. We don't have to either build brand new or take something right off the shelf from another location. We can look at what has worked and make it work for Portland. And that's been missing. That's been missing here.
Yeah. To go back to the survey that KBOO did this summer, another big issue that we found was, you know, coming up for a lot of people was this issue of economic livability and just being able to afford to live in Portland. What does Portland need to do to become more affordable?
We need to be doing a better job at making sure we have an affordable community. So what does it look like to have affordable housing, not just subsidized housing, but what some people call workforce housing, that housing that is affordable to people who are working an hourly wage job and don't qualify for subsidies, but also can't afford a $600,000 starter house. And we need to make sure that our housing stock, both how much housing we have, but also what type of housing we have, provides opportunities for every member of our community. That our transportation system is robust enough that people can get around by transportation, active transportation, that the things that make a community affordable for people to live in are here so that people who work in Portland can live in Portland. We also, though, need to work on the other end, which is what is a good job in our city? And there are plenty of programs at the city and at every level of government that say if you receive a subsidy from our city, our county, our state, you have to pay at least an average wage to your workers. Well, when the average wage doesn't buy you a house or pay the rent in Portland, requiring that a company pay the average wage is absolutely unacceptable. We need to be reviewing those programs and looking at where we should be requiring better, where the city should be a driver of above average wages so that we can start to raise the floor and make sure that, again, people who work here not only can afford to live here because our housing is affordable, but can afford to pay the rent or buy the house because their wages are high enough. A lot of policies do inadvertently hurt, whether it's a small landlord, a small business, as we try to lift folks up. And we don't need to do that. We can make sure that we craft policies in a way that brings everybody up. As Jennifer said, part of doing that is looking honestly at what the cost drivers are. And one of the things that we've seen in Portland, and it is not unique to Portland, we're seeing it in cities across, I believe across the country, certainly across the West, is investment funds coming in and buying up rental properties. And these outside funds buying up our rental properties in Portland means that you have people who are pushing the limits of what we allow under our current rent caps. You have groups that are looking at bottom line, how do they make as much money as possible, as opposed to bottom line, how do they invest in a sustainable community in Portland? Because if Portland's not making money anymore, they'll pull their money out. They'll sell those buildings and move on to the next market. And so we need to be looking at how we can support investment within our own community. And that's something that Portland has struggled with for a long time. We don't have the big money here to invest in our own community in the way that a lot of other big cities do. And that's a conversation that I think we need to be having so that we can figure out how we take the medium-sized money that we do have to lift everybody up. And that's a wonky piece, but it's a piece that I think is an important part of the puzzle in figuring out how we do better by our own community.
Mm-hmm. I want to pivot the conversation now to community safety, which is something that I think both of you have mentioned in your platforms as something that needs work.
I'm going to go a step further and say that our entire public safety system is broken in Portland. It's not keeping anybody safe. It's not allowing almost any of the players within our public safety system to work at their best. And it would be very simple to change that. So right now, when we talk about our public safety system, we have a bucket for police and Portland Street Response and how we respond to folks on the street, how we respond to crime. We have a bucket for fire and medical, that is our fire department, our ambulance service. I think we need to have three buckets. Our fire and medical bucket, fire service, ambulance service, our response to crimes led by our police, and our response to folks who are in crisis. Portland Street Response, Project Respond at the county. There are a number of other services that provide supports to folks who are in crisis. And if we start to think about our public safety system in three buckets, fund it that way, set up policies so that they can be successful, and budget for it that way, I think we can start to have a public safety system that works. But if you think about changes that were made in the medical system where we said, gosh, nobody is working at the top of their degree, at the top of what they are allowed to do, because they're picking up so much work doing other things. Think about our public safety system that same way, right? I would like somebody who is trained in social work or mental health care, responding to folks who are in crisis. They have the training to do that. That is their best use in our community. I would like police officers to be closing cases and investigating crimes. Portland has right now one of the lowest case closure rates that we've ever had, and compared to most other cities. And when we don't have case closures, when our police officers are not actually figuring out what happened, solving crimes, we're not keeping our communities safe.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio. I'm Althea Billings, the news director. In this episode, we're revisiting Running on Air, our Portland candidate roundtable series. We're hearing from the winners of District 2, Samir Kanal, Dan Ryan, and Ilana Pertelgini. consider supporting the important work we do at KABU with a donation during our Catalog of Connections drive. We're aiming to raise $75,000 by the end of the year. Can you help us out? Donate online at kabu.fm/give or text the word KABU to 44321 to show your support for grassroots community radio. Let's get back to the show.
We'll be hearing from Samir Kanal, running to represent District 2. So let's start by talking about why you want to run and how much the change in the city charter and the change in the way that we're electing our city council has affected your decision to run. And I'll start with Samir.
Yeah, thanks for having me. My name is Samir Kanal. I'm a candidate in North and Northeast Portland District 2. I chose to run largely because of my experience working at the city, where I was the project manager of the Police Accountability Commission, and doing community engagement and public safety through that and other processes, and seeing how it matters a great deal to Portlanders to express what we want to our government, and it matters a lot to the frontline staff who receive it. But the higher up the org chart that community engagement goes, the less it seems to matter on the whole. And that motivated me to run, because ultimately we need a city council that is going to listen to the people of Portland and make policy decisions that reflect our priorities.
Well, it's interesting to me that you were on the Police Accountability Commission. As a member of the public, my sense was that the city council was not responsive to the reasons why the commission was even formed. And I wonder if that's influenced your desire to run for city council.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I wonder how you see your role in running for city council as being part of this movement, maybe to really reshape Portland in a way that makes the city council, the city government, much more responsive to the needs of Portlanders. We'll start with Samir.
Yeah, so first I should say that the ranked choice voting process and multi-member districts is another part for me of why I also decided to run. I think it allows for more representation, not only in terms of districts, which is great, but also within the district. As one of the few candidates who lives out on the peninsula, I live in Portsmouth, I think that's a big part of it too. That area is not represented historically. I think our responsibility as candidates is to both indicate where we stand, but also talk about the things that matter to Portlanders, as well as ensuring that we are building coalitions now and have a track record of doing so. I think Portlanders, the people who talk to me talk about wanting candidates and electeds who can count to seven, who can build consensus, and having that experience in my past and being able to say, I'm not just doing that in terms of my job, but also even as a candidate. I've done events with 11 other candidates so far. And so having these events where you can show we can work together, and ultimately, the campaign as a whole, regardless of who wins, and obviously I hope I do, but regardless of who wins, I think it can show Portlanders that we can work together and give a little bit of hope for the future to a population that I think has lost a lot of faith in the ability of the city government to accomplish big things.
It's interesting that you're from Portsmouth. It's an area that has been historically underrepresented
Yes.
in the city government. And I want to talk a little bit about how you see that would change the way the city functions if your part of your neighborhood was actually represented in the government.
Yeah, so I'm originally from Overlook. I was born there. And so that allows us to talk about issues like connectivity, talking about building light rail from St. John's to the airport. That's a conversation that may not be obvious why it's important if you live in Southeast, but if you're in North Portland, you understand. And in terms of representation, yeah, having people from that area we can speak to, we have shade equity issues too. Obviously, East Portland gets a lot of attention, and deservedly so, about its lack of trees, and I want to make sure that when I'm on council, I'm supporting East Portland as well. But, you know, I live pretty close to that Eagles Lodge on Lombard, which is now the Underground Wrestling, and just walking there when it was hot out in the summertime, there is a large temperature difference in surface temperature within 2-3 blocks of that area. And there's more to it than that, too. We have a higher percentage of renters. I'm a renter. I've been a renter my entire adult life. There are aspects of the candidates you're going to see from that area that reflect the uniqueness of those neighborhoods. And I think that's really important when we're building a team of 12 people.
Well, another thing about your neighborhood is that you are burdened with most of the pollution in Portland. And there's all these industries that create intense pollution, and you're close to the CEI hub. So how does that also affect the vision that you would bring to city council?
I have asthma, so I'm pretty used to noticing air quality issues that maybe other people don't. And climate change is an existential threat. We need leaders that are going to address it with the urgency that it deserves. I think being able to build a coalition on city council to do some really big things, like eventually relocating the CEI hub, preventing the transport of dangerous chemicals through the city, phasing out leaded fuel at Portland International Raceway, in the short term withdrawing Zenith's authorization, the land use compatibility statement. There's so many specific things there that may not be top of mind to folks who don't live in that area. It's definitely top of mind for me. And I've been grateful to have these, you know, information provided by people like Tank the Tanks and the folks in Linton who've been working on this for a lot longer than I have. And so much of what we can do as government is listen to people who already are experts on their own neighborhoods and admit when we don't know everything there is to know. I don't know everything there is to know about your neighborhood. Whoever you are listening to this, you know where a crosswalk needs to be on your block better than I do. And when we go out and say we need to paint a crosswalk, we should listen to the people who live there and say, here's where the safety hazard is.
How would you be working with somebody who, for instance, had opposed the ballot, the charter change, and has this, you know, and also might want to undermine some of the initiatives that have been passed in recent years by the voters?
Yeah, so first, I would say that maybe 20% of the city is a registered Republican. They deserve to be represented on their city council, and they haven't been. There are people who are much further to the left than people that have been elected, and people whose views don't fit neatly into a box, and everybody deserves to be represented, and I think the new form of government will do that. It breeds a more honest politics. I lived in Seattle for college. I left, I came back, and in between, they changed their form of government, not quite as much or in the same way as we did, but it did yield a more diverse council ideologically. And as someone who's worked on advisory groups where we're trying to make sure that they're representative of the city, including ideological diversity, I think that's really valuable. I think, again, the way I would work with people who are supportive of a different vision of the charter is to say, you know, let us try this first. Let's do it in a way that addresses whatever the fear is. If it's a preference issue, I think we have to, you know, go back to what the voters voted for. And that's not, you know, I think we could all say, if I was writing this from scratch, would I write it exactly the same on any of these ballot measures? And the answer is probably no. And that's actually one of the challenges with ballot measures in the first place. I talk about building a city that listens, because a city that listens is safer and more prosperous for everyone. And the issue with ballot measures, we govern a lot through ballot measures in Portland, is that they are themselves a reflection of people feeling that they weren't listened to by their elected leaders in the first place.